The following program was produced by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org, and is broadcast in partnership with Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM.
Composers John Cage and Morton Feldman, in a free-ranging conversation at the WBAI studios in New York in 1966.
This is Charles Ruas welcoming you to a program from my audio archives from the 1970s. As Director of Arts Programming at WBAI-FM, the Pacifica radio station in New York City, I produced programs that covered all the contemporary arts, including drama, literature, and experimental radio programs as well.
With the cooperation of Clock Tower, these programs have been restored for broadcast on Clock Tower Radio, operating at clocktower.org.
Last week, after we had talked, I mentioned to you that an idea that was in a Kaufman article, let me read it to you. It comes toward the end of an article that's in the Architectural Forum for September of last year. And it was taken from a talk that he gave at Aspen, where I also spoke. I was extremely impressed by his talk, and I think you'll be interested in these ideas. It's about design, but nowadays it seems to me that anything is about anything else, and that this is can be interpreted as being about sociology or about being about music or whatever. He says, then there is the idea of disposability. It seems to me that disposability is the incarnation of the new possibilities of immaterialism. In other words, the value of an object is not in the object. It is in how people think about it, how they got it to you, and what you can do with it. But it isn't a valuable thing anymore. This seems to me a tremendous resource. He was talking about resources for people designing. Disposability, too, gives new meaning to an old, exhausted word, quality. It used to be talked about a great deal in design circles some decades ago, but quality, in the world of disposability, means the quality of being common, not the quality of being exclusive. And finally, disposability puts new vigor into the idea of improvement and change in design. If things are being produced in such great quantities and of such little intrinsic commercial value that it is easy to dispose of them, then variety, change, and alteration can be much more flexible. Now, this is the idea I thought would especially interest you. Finally, and maybe first in order of importance, we have today that possibility which arises with the increase of the very large scale and the very small scale and the dwindling of the middle scale. Der Verlust der Mitte, to borrow a bit out of context a neat German phrase. But a great increase in the size of social functions and social organizations leaves much more freedom for the minutely individual person, the minutely individual family. Within the great impersonality of the world of mass production and total near disposability, there comes clear for the first time the possibility of intense personalism as a proper balance and as a proper enrichment of life. The loss of the middle scale can be one of our greatest victories. Don't you think that's marvelous?
Yes, very fine.
One thinks immediately of that piece that you wrote for Merce Cunningham, Summer Space, which you call Ixion, where the music is all high. There is no middle in the piece at all, for a brief moment it goes to the very low sounds and then back to the high. So that, in a sense, that piece written almost 10 years ago, wasn't it?
Yes.
Is in musical terms this particular statement. And then his, I've been saying for so many years now that we have quality everywhere, that what we want is not quality, but quantity. I'm not so sure that you would agree with that.
Well, what is that old saying? God proposes, man disposes?
Yes.
We do that anyway. Well, I never really saw art, in a sense, in terms of its permanence, because I, for one, could never pin it down. So I was never left the feeling with something very tangible or an object. Recently, I was at the Guggenheim, and in a new requisition, they have an absolutely gorgeous Cézanne. He brings the picture plane so dangerously close to the eyes that you can't see it anyway.
Yeah.
It's almost as if you keep the experience but you dispose of the painting. I think a lot of work in the past, at least psychologically, serve that dual function. Rauschenberg, I mean, obviously, it's fixed for all time, but it spreads itself out into the room as well. And even a more conventional painter like Gustin, the wake seems to creep along the walls.
Yes.
You know, though obviously it's been done on a canvas. Did you really mean what you said about more quantity and less quality? Or how did you really mean it?
I mean it in several ways. I find that through our experience of painting and now music, that everything we experience has, so to speak, quality. So what we would like to do is have to continue to have experience, in other words, quantity, to go on having more and more experience, since it all has quality. You follow that?
Yes.
Then in the other sense, I think our... well, remember how a piece was in the days, for instance, when music was on 78 records, 3 minutes seemed like a long time. Then when LPs came in, 20 to 30 minutes seemed a perfectly reasonable length of time. And now through our concerts, You could have several hours and it wouldn't seem long. It could go on and on and on and on. And whether we want that quantity or whether I think it corresponds with how we're living in the sense of corresponding like something you don't even think about, like breathing. That our time sense has changed, but that it's involved more and more, not with short periods of time, but with ones that formerly used to be considered long, and so can be, you speak of the word quantity. I just saw a play of Gertrude Stein with incidental music by Richard Winslow up at Wesleyan University, and it was in two parts with an intermission in between, and when the performance stopped altogether, everyone remained in his seat. No one wanted to leave. They would have been perfectly happy had it gone on and on and on. Of course, this sense of going on and on and on was foreseen perhaps first, or among the first in recent times, by Gertrude Stein. Isn't it also implicit in Finnegan's Wake, with the fact that the book ends with its beginning, so that it's, so to speak, endless? Now, as far as the word quality goes, in either case of Stein or Joyce, you wouldn't really want to say page 267 is preferable to page 66.
Well, John, I don't think that Joyce had to worry about quality.
No, there.
But in a sense, I think it's something, in a sense.
But through Joyce, through Stein, through modern painting, through our music and so forth, and everywhere we look is quality.
Well,
I mean to say, walking down a street is now equivalent to reading Finnegan's Wake.
Well, I didn't want to use these terms, but what I'm really getting at, which I didn't feel that I would want to get at, was where do we come in?
Who do you mean?
The artist. Now, I wouldn't be hurt if you tell me
where
that
do
it's
we go
all
out?
Over.
Where do we go?
Where do we go?
Yeah.
No, that's better. Where do we go out?
Well, now let's see.
Now, I'm not going to... I mean, in a sense, I'm very close to you. I'm as close to you as I'm here this afternoon. And so I would be the last one to say that I would prefer page 6 of A Certain Peace of Mind to page 8 or page 9. And I wouldn't say that page 9 makes the piece... or give it its quality. I wouldn't even say that the overall structure or the compositional ideas give it its quality. But again, where do we leave?
No, but what you said about the Cézanne just a moment ago, how did you put it? The picture was so... it was so close to you,
Yes.
That you didn't need it anymore. Now, if you didn't need it, you surely could... What's the position of Cézanne? I guess you still give him an essential position.
Well, he made it possible for me to say I don't need it.
Yes, he made it possible actually for you not to need him. Could you not now...
Maybe it's the other way. Maybe I needed him more than I needed the picture.
That may be the case. Now, we don't want to say where do we come in or where do we go out, because we would like, I think, to stay, to not leave, but to stay here now that we're here.
I'm not ready to leave.
Exactly. So the question is...
It's like dying.
The question is more... How do we spend our time? Do we require? What do we require in order to enjoy ourselves? In a social sense. Do we want to? We don't just want to enjoy ourselves alone, but we want to enjoy ourselves in society, right? With other people.
Well, maybe we can enjoy ourselves alone. I was reading an article, but a remark of Sartre's. He's very annoyed with most men. He prefers the company of women. He said that if he's sitting in a cafe, the man wants to talk shop. He wants to be intellectual. He said that he could do alone. Well, a woman would talk about life, you see.
But our conversations, for instance, here, had we been having them, say, 50 years ago, we would probably have been talking about music.
Now, they would have been much shorter and had much quality.
Yeah. Now we think, even if we're not talking about music, that somehow it has relevance to music.
Crucial.
Right. So it's no longer it's a form of enjoyment, actually, to converse. I would say on any subject. One might even describe, as I believe Mead did, civilization in terms of conversation. And he included soliloquy, that is to say, conversation, as being possible, one person speaking to himself.
I suppose it all boils down to this business of vested interest. I spend so much time getting rid of history that to dispose now I would have to get rid of my own history. When I was in England, I gave a lecture someplace, and a young man got up during the question period, and he said, in reference to Mr. Cage's remark, is everything music, Mr. Feldman? And I thought for a moment, and I said, well, I can't speak for Mr. Cage, but maybe I might take the responsibility and add to the remark of his and say, yes, everything is music, but not everyone is an artist. Now, we might be able to break down any type of preconceptions that we might have about music. At the same time, we might be able to break down, of course, the preconceptions or the prerequisites that we would think one, you know, usually thinks of an artist as having. At the same time, as I'm leaving, I'm very aware that I could do things that other people can't do. That is, maybe I can leave. And it's not a question of my own survival or my own vested interests, but I think that there is a mistake and thinking. Well, just as there was a mistake to think that with the old music or with the older painting, people dug it, people saw it for what it is. And I think that same mistake will happen again on these new times. Unless we reach a state where there is no longer that need for involvement with what we do. The whole... It's amazing, John. It's just amazing how the whole... idea of impermanence has even taken hold of, say, in the chic fashion world, where they would make expensive paper dresses. Mm. I'm not confused about the issue, but I really don't know how to approach it. I mean, we might bring something into the world. It is us that did it. The fact that it might be impermanent seems to be... I can't see it's philosophical and sociological ramification. I would rather see it, in a sense, more in its religious element. I know that when I write a piece sometimes, I'm telling people, we're not going to be here very long.
Well, and the pieces of yours which... on graph paper, which change each time.
Yes.
Are there only that instant?
Yes, but the model repeats itself in each piece.
But differently.
Yes.
As, for instance, in... certainly there's as much difference between each performance of one of those works as there is between all the mushrooms of a given species. They arise from a particular genetic situation. And each one is different, although they're recognizable. But what we enjoy now is those differences, don't you think? Or do you think you'd enjoy the non-existent or invisible thing from which these differences come?
I don't really know from where they come.
Well, in the case of your graph music, they come from the composition.
Yes.
Now, the question is very simple. Do you prefer the composition, or do you like hearing the music?
I like hearing the music.
Of course. And you wouldn't really think, if someone made a serious mistake, that anything calamitous had taken place, any more than I would think if I saw a hybrid among two species of mushrooms that something unforgivable had happened. I would rather be interested.
The only difference is that if a serious mistake is made in my music by a performer, I attribute it to his character. I don't think you would attribute it to the character of a mushroom.
No, but in the course of that divergence from your composition,
yes,
something would happen which you would notice. Now the question is whether you would be able to notice it as being interesting, or whether you would own, or whether you would not notice it because you were clinging to the composition. Hmm?
No, I would notice it as being interesting.
I think so. It might even be part of this conversation that goes on endlessly, to which you would later reply with another composition. Hmm? Either to establish the species more clearly so that those divergences would be infrequent, hmm? Or to do something so that
be
divergences would increase. Hmm?
Yes, that's my newest piece. That's exactly the piece I'm writing now.
This is since the... tell me what it is.
It's a piece for orchestra called In Search of an Orchestration, where it is very loosely controlled in terms of register, in terms of the way the timbre lines up vertically, and it allows for great diversions.
How does the notation go?
It's graphic.
With numbers?
It's with numbers.
But not high, middle, and low?
Not high, middle, and low.
Just the numbers?
Just the numbers. Occasionally I would have an arrow indicating either high or low.
Uh-huh.
But very, very rarely.
Isn't that marvelous?
And it's for a very big orchestra.
What about the dynamics?
Well, the dynamics are still soft.
Mm-hmm. Not loud at all, ever?
Not loud at all.
You remember, years ago, there were sporadic loud sounds. What made them disappear?
I think they existed as some form of punctuation.
That you felt was no longer necessary?
Yes.
Really?
I think that I was still involved. I don't remember. Mm-hmm. But I think I was still involved with some element of differentiation.
Mm-hmm. They'd be, though, wouldn't they, like the opposite of punctuation? Since by being louder they would stand out?
Exclamation points. I don't know what happened, John. Maybe I heard too much of its attack. Maybe I didn't hear. Maybe I had some notion about the purity of the sound itself being lost in the loudness of the attack.
At any rate, it appeared to you as unnecessary to the rest of the music. Mm.
Yes, it also, in a sense, created a certain amount of energy that I felt that I had to use. They became an interference of some kind. Remember in my earlier graph pieces where they would say the woodwinds would be given a long period of time in which to make their entrance, but they would make it to some degree chronologically,
mm-hmm.
in time. In this new piece, they begin any place within this structure, not in the beginning. In other words, he doesn't begin on the beat or off the beat. He could begin at the very end of the structure. which was quite different from me.
Mm.
Because I was still filling out some type of chronological information. But let's get back to that very touching phrase, where do we leave? Maybe we need classes like in some religious schools where they remind the children of death every day. So when it comes, they should be prepared. Maybe we need that in our music classes.
It's very curious. When I was in London recently, I spoke at one of the universities, and I apparently talked a good deal about death and age and so forth. And one of the students said, you didn't used to do this. Is it because you're getting older?
You know, maybe the reason that the way you talked earlier about time and how the fact that as it's getting longer, as it's getting sublimely monotonous, to quote a phrase of Robert Lowe's, do you think a lot of it has to do with the fact that we live longer?
And we may live much longer than we do now.
Yes.
Buckminster Fuller says he will live to be 120. Suzuki died at 96. More and more attention is being paid by physicians to the process of aging, which they say is not necessarily connected with degeneration. And we may be living to extensive ages. I asked a rabbi recently whether he thought that Methuselah actually lived to be 900 and something, you know, and he immediately became apologetic for the Bible. It may be that Methuselah did live that long, and that people will be living that long.
I remember a lecture where the anthropologist was showing various specimens, various skulls of a certain period, and he pointed out that each skull had its teeth in practically perfect condition. But if you would notice carefully, there'll be a bump on each skull's head, some rather indentation where he was suddenly hit over the head, you know. As he went into the concert hall. John, a drastic switch in mood and thought. Why do you think so many well-known composers in America are noticeably silent during this Vietnam problem?
You mean silent where painters are not?
Where painters and other intellectuals are not.
Well, there are other things that distinguish music in general from the other arts, but in a university, for instance, where I think, by and large, among the art students, you would find a great interest in other fields than art. In the music school, you'll find the majority concerned with absolutely nothing but scales, harmonies, melodies, rhythms, etc. I think it's because the Well, you did say composers, but I think musicians in general are not so much involved with ideas as they are just with music. Not only ideas, but life itself.
And then if that's the case, the sooner we leave it, the better off we'll be. Because that thought did come to me that as we were talking, it started to grow. And there seems to be something absolutely wrong with the hothouse cloistered teaching of music in America. And that conservatism, I think, actually spread to every other important area of their life, and it's very noticeable today. But even the older people are just noticeably absent.
This is emphasized too by much of the criticism, the program notes for concerts, so forth. I went to a concert just recently in across the Ohio from Cincinnati in Kentucky, and it included L'Histoire du Soldat of Stravinsky and work from the 20s by Prokofiev, and the notes, the whole situation was as though you were as though it were culture, as though it had absolutely nothing to do with anything but music. Not even to do with music now, referring now to the program notes, but that those were just historical about the 20s. So that one was spending the evening touring at a comfortable distance from the present.
And probably a comfortable distance from what really prompted the Histoire du Soldat.
Mm. What do you think one should do now with reference to the war in Vietnam? Do you think, for instance, that parading with posters and so forth, or adding your name to an advertisement in the New York Times or a letter in the New York Times is an action that will accomplish the desire, which is to stop that war? Hmm?
I see so many names I know and say European protests. I see practically no names I know in the American protest. I was very impressed in an advertisement in the Times, put out by a peace group from America, getting names of prominent composers and artists, you know, in Europe, to see, say, for example, Stockhausen's name, Benjamin Britten's name, and then Boulez's name was, and position was used very tellingly in the Algerian crisis.
You mean, by tellingly, what do you mean? Did it accomplish something?
It had its impact. ultimately. It helped. It added.
You know, my tendency is to think of these activities of protest and of parades and objections and all these things as being like critical actions rather than like composing actions. I know in my own case, and certainly in your case, that nothing that the critics said stopped me from composing. Now, it seems to me that the war is not going to be stopped by critical action, or if it is stopped, that it will be succeeded by another war, etc. I think something like a composing action needs to be made, rather than like a critical action, in order to bring about a world where these things to which we clearly and rightfully object will not take place.
But wouldn't you agree?
I concur with Buckminster Fuller's view that rather than objecting to war, we should apply ourselves to tripling the world's resources and their effective usefulness, and that means distribution and so forth, so that the world will not be divided as it is now between those who have and those who do not have. He believes that when that design problem is solved, that then, if war takes place, our objections will be rational and effective, as our objections now to slavery are, because through the invention of machines we no longer have need of the muscles of slaves. But if we simply object to war without removing the cause for it, we can expect it to pop up first here, then there, then another place. I think, in fact, that engaging in critical action accumulates virtue for those who object and somehow relieves them of any sense of their having to do something compositional.
Now, I...
What's going to happen, for instance, when the next presidential election comes along? Talk with anyone you know about it. No one expects that a president will be suggested whom we will truly want. Or whom we would think would produce a relation between the United States and the world that we would be agreeing with. Should we say immediately that we don't agree and that we will not agree ever? I've thought of a number of things. I've thought of renouncing citizenship as a gesture. Immediately someone says, well, you'd be more effective if you stay in this bad situation. But I truly don't see any effective meaning in critical action.
And so what's going to happen is that you're going to have your disposal of the creative people in America anyway. Now it's been happening.
What do you mean by that?
Well, if we would actually think back, we would... I think that what I'm saying is true. The... that the creative person in America, especially, has always had a kind of anonymity.
You mean that his position aside from the society, or what do you mean?
Yes.
Yes.
Always.
Yes.
And
but that's growing less, I think.
I think it will grow more.
You do?
Yes.
I think it'll grow, well, go ahead.
And the reason for this was something which ordinarily I would have considered a virtue. That is his individuality. I think that his insistence on his own individuality in this specific issue points up the tragic flaw in the artistic personality in America. I think that the issue, that it's actually simple, that being that we cannot identify with any particular type of political stance, we don't know what to do. At the same time, we were always safeguarding this individuality for our art. Now, here's a test where we can use this individuality in protesting the war in Vietnam. And yet, none of this individuality is used.
No, but I would rather use that energy.
Well, one surely could do both, I think.
Of course, we can do lots of things. But I think the useful thing to do is going to be to further world consciousness as opposed to U.S. consciousness. And I think that this can be done effectively through support of Buckminster Fuller's World Resources Inventory and all such ideas, which I find mounting to a vast chorus in the United States and outside of the United States. So that rather than objecting to the activities of the United States to promote the coming into being of world society,
well, the only problem that I could think of in the moment is that it, what you say is utterly realistic in terms of its long-range program and utterly unrealistic for the moment.
I, on the contrary, Marty, I think these things are happening. They are not being delayed. Our global village is coming into existence. We have signs of it. Not premonitions, but actual tangible evidences of it over and over and over again.
I believe you. I believe that's true. But the White House doesn't know it.
Well, the White House has other problems, too. What is so interesting is that the objectives of politics and economics now in their power goals are becoming increasingly difficult to present to a public in such a way as to gain enthusiasm for those goals. Whereas to present the goals of world society is becoming increasingly easy. To present as something which gains enthusiasm. Then when you, a simple thing like that blackout of a year ago, wasn't it? When we discovered that the electricity which we use each day so often is connected with the university in Canada. I mean with the electricity in Canada. Why not with the electricity in Russia, in China? We know that when it is a global network, that it will be vastly more economical, far more suitable for the larger numbers of people who will be living, that the whole world must shift from its present preoccupation with competition to a world of cooperation. And eventually,
this is happening in the arts as well.
Exactly, and that cooperation will be necessary even from a selfish point of view.
No more slaves.
I'm reading a book now, picked it up in one of the airports, called The Worldly Philosopher's History of Economics. On the first pages you learn something which maybe ought not to have surprised me, but did. That the spending your life trying to gain something is a very recent modern way of spending one's life. That formerly one did things without being paid for them, simply because he was born into that situation. Very much as we've spent our lives with music. Something about us, the Lord knows genetically or how, somehow or through some kind of curious set of circumstances, we got involved with music, almost as though it weren't our fault, and we weren't paid for it, but that didn't disturb us. We continued.
And now it disturbs the young people.
Well,
the young composers.
But that way of living, that way of doing what it was that one was doing, was characteristic of life in the Middle Ages. And apparently is going to become characteristic again. Whether the man who's writing that history of economics knows McLuhan or not, I don't know, but everything seems to have changed with the invention of printing. And you can talk on almost any subject and you find those ideas of McLuhan corroborated over and over again. And I heard, for instance, of great advances now in education where a child just fiddling away on a typewriter has the typewriter speaking back to him, saying gently, try again, you made a mistake that time. So that you have a way of teaching which involves the ears and so forth, and which carries the child really back into a situation far more comparable to the Middle Ages than to all of the Renaissance education which we had. And this is more and more taken as a matter of course. You don't even have to know anything about music to believe these things. I was asked recently in Cincinnati whether I thought that that now a student should have a thorough education in music. So I simply said, well, if you were going to become an astronaut, would you spend your time with horses, brushing them and cleaning out the stables?
This is Charles Ruas. You've been listening to a selection from my historic archives.
With the cooperation of Clock Tower, these programs have been restored for broadcast on Clock Tower Radio, operating at clocktower.org.
Composers John Cage and Morton Feldman in a free-ranging conversation at the WBAI studios in New York in 1966.
The previous program was produced by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org, and is broadcast in partnership with Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM.